Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Okay, we're back. Thanks for listening once again. And as I mentioned earlier in the show today, I want to spend a lot of time reading emails. We have such a stack of emails that have come in, so I want to try to get through as many as possible. Who knows? Maybe one of them is yours. And if you'd like to send me an email, just go to the show page, relevantradio.com/Patrick. Be sure to put the slash Patrick on the end there. Otherwise, it will take you to a different place. Relevantradio.com/Patrick. And then you'll see just below where it says the Patrick Madrid Show, you'll see about, links, and contact. So if you want to send me an email, just press contact and you can send me an email. It comes directly to me. I read them all and I'm grateful for all of you, whether you agree with me or not, taking time out of your busy day to send me a message. I do appreciate that. And if I can, I will read it on the air. Here's an email that comes in from Marie. She says, I'm a Catholic single parent who raised five kids and worked very hard to educate them all in Catholic schools because of my faith and the importance of them knowing the Lord. They're all grown adults now. My heart is broken with my eldest son's situation, and I would greatly appreciate your words of wisdom because I don't know if I've done wrong. I raised my kids with morals and values to carry them into their own lives. My oldest son has forgotten all this and will condone all of his narcissistic wife's doings, regardless of how much it hurts my family. Needless to say, she's broken my family, and I've asked my son to fix things. We were allowed to see my son maybe every 2 years, but since my last talk with him, he completely stopped talking to all of us. His wife would monitor his texts, emails, and calls from us. I was told she had put a spell on my son, but I don't believe in those things. My son has a heart of gold, and his ways just don't make sense to me. This is not the son I raised. In my heart, I know my son is not happy, and he's afraid of her. Throughout their 9 years of marriage, I always respected my daughter-in-law and put up with her disrespect and evil ways because she is my son's wife. I am 64 years old. I should be respected. They live several hours away from where I live, but they don't visit because I live in an apartment community. They travel 9 hours to see her parents all the time because, as she told me, they have their own room at their mother's house when they visit. Her family is wealthy. The sad part is that my son allows her to belittle his siblings and his mother. My question is, did I do wrong by asking my son to talk to his wife about being so ugly toward us? I told him I would no longer allow her to disrespect his sisters and brothers anymore. I also asked that she apologize for hurting my family the way she has. I didn't include myself because I was just thinking of my kids. Did I do wrong for asking my son to fix things? Life is all about her, and it saddens me that my son has always wanted kids, and she never told him that she couldn't have children until 1 year into their marriage. My son saw my efforts and struggles to provide for them, and now he has turned to her rich ways. I pray for her and ask God to change her heart. Thank you for your time. I just love your program because it has kept me sane. God bless you for all you do. Sincerely, Marie. All right, Marie. What an amazing letter, and filled with several important things that are worth talking about. So first thing is, you have my sincere empathy and sympathy that you're having to go through this. But, you know, in this life, this kind of a problem, although it's not necessarily common, it's also not that uncommon. So if nothing else, just be aware that you're going through something that other moms and dads have had to deal with before. And maybe I can share with you some suggestions on the basis of what I've seen other people have to go through. So the first thing is, no, to answer your question directly, you did not do anything wrong, certainly did not commit a sin. You did not do anything wrong by asking your son to sort this out with his wife so that she would stop acting this way. Now, obviously, there are always at least two sides to any story, usually three sides, and we all are conditioned by our own biases and our own impression of events. So taking into account the fact that maybe the reality might be somewhat less dire than what it seems to you to be, I don't doubt the fact that this woman, your daughter-in-law, has acted in these ways against you and against the rest of your family. There's a lot here that suggests that they have a really unhealthy relationship. And I want to get into a couple of aspects of that because there's some really big red flags here that I want to address. But taking into account that from her standpoint, it probably looks different to her, which is why I would assume that when you asked your son to take it up with her, and assuming that he did, it probably is why she was so defensive about it, because perhaps in her eyes, she doesn't see what to you looks like a lot of damage. I'm sure she's justified in her own eyes. In her eyes, she thinks that she's done what she should do, or that she's above reproach. But it sounds like, objectively speaking, she has been really mean-spirited and all the other things that you say. So I don't disagree with you, and I certainly don't doubt that what you're saying is true. So how do you handle it? We've dispatched the first part of the question, which is, did you do anything wrong? No, you didn't do anything wrong. How could it be wrong to try to make things better and taking steps by asking your son if he'd be willing to talk about this with his wife? So I would suggest, my humble suggestion to you would be to put that thought to rest, that you didn't do anything wrong. Now, sometimes you do the right thing and it makes things worse. So if that's what you meant by saying, did you do something wrong? No, you didn't do anything wrong. But as sometimes happens in life, with your best intentions and doing the right thing, sometimes still a situation can deteriorate. And that may be what's going on here. But let's address a couple of these red flags in reverse order. The first one, which comes later in your letter, but it's the really big red flag, is that for whatever reason, she had a tubal ligation or a hysterectomy or something. You said that she could not have children, but she didn't reveal this to your son until a year after they were married. Well, I'm assuming that they got married in the church. I hope they got married in the church. But that would be grounds for an annulment. What I mean by that is, two things here. One is that if either or both parties enter into a marriage with the express intention of not having children, that would be an impediment. That would mean that the marriage would not be able to be valid, because that in itself would invalidate the marriage or the attempt at marriage. Then one of the necessary ingredients is the willingness to accept children if God should bless you with children. Now, it may be that somebody has a medical condition. It may be that the woman had a hysterectomy when she was younger. Maybe she had cancer. There was some other issue and she had a hysterectomy and that was medically prescribed and she didn't do anything immoral. Okay. Sometimes those things happen. But the other problem, and so the problem of not being able to conceive a child in itself is not an impediment. If the woman in this case had this medical procedure and she was thereby unable to have any children, that would not be grounds for an annulment. That would not invalidate an attempt at marriage. But what would do that would be the fact that she didn't reveal this, because this is a massive dimension of the marriage contract. The marriage contract, let's keep in mind, is where the two parties, the husband and the wife, they publicly, freely, without reserve, they grant permission to each other to have and to hold till death do us part, in sickness and in health, for better or for worse. It's a mutual self-giving of everything, including their bodies, one to the other. So if she concealed this fact, even if she had a medical procedure that rendered her unable to have children, or maybe it was just some other condition that she had. She didn't necessarily have to have a medical procedure. But if, in fact, she was unable to have children, that's something that she would be duty-bound to tell the man before they got married, because that may change everything. And that would, I think for many men, maybe not all, maybe not even most, but many men, it would change their mind on whether or not they wanted to get married to this woman if they knew ahead of time, these men, that the woman, so let's take a particular man, if he knew that the woman he was going to marry could never have children with him, He might say, well, I'm sorry, but I want to have children. And I want to marry a woman with whom I have a reasonable likelihood of having children. That's only fair. That's only reasonable. And so to conceal that intentionally from him before the marriage is a very clear-cut example of where the church, after reviewing all the information, I'm certain would say, well, that was an invalid marriage. Now, just for a moment to return back to the other scenario, I mentioned that there were two big issues here. The other big issue would be if she had, let's say that she had this procedure so that she would never have children, aside from the fact that she didn't reveal this to him, which is a terrible thing unto itself, that right there, if she went into a marriage, whether she had told him about it or hadn't told him about it, if her intention was never to have children, that too would be grounds for an annulment. That too would be an example of an impediment that would have rendered the attempt at marriage null. Now, I don't want to get too bogged down in that, but the reason I mention this and the reason I reference it at some length here is because, now, naturally, the church would have to make the final decision on this, and that's where the annulment process comes in. But by all appearances, it certainly looks to me as though he's in an invalid marriage, meaning that he's not actually married to her in the eyes of God and the church. Now, that's for the church to determine. That's not for me to determine. I'm only giving you my opinion on the basis of what it appears to me. And don't go by that. Because if he were to separate from her and come to his senses and realize, wait a minute, there's something really wrong here. And if he were to initiate the annulment process and the church were to investigate, based upon what you're telling me here, it sounds to me like this would pop up like a major red flag. And they would say that's grounds for an annulment right there. I think you see the point that I'm making. So this is somewhat hypothetical. If it should happen that down the road they wind up separating or wind up getting a divorce, just keep this in your back pocket. Keep this information in your back pocket because it's the kind of thing that he should know about. So let's proceed to the other major red flag. The other major red flag is that you said that you think, and I want to go back to exactly how you put it here, you said that you were told that she put a spell on your son. Now, you mentioned that you don't believe in those things, and I could understand why you'd say that, but let me tell you, this is real. These kinds of things are real. There are people who will try to put a hex or a curse on somebody, the evil eye. There are different names for it. And they will try to enlist the help of the evil one and his minions to torment and harass and control somebody else through the form of a hex or a spell. So I know that it's not the kind of thing that you and I as followers of Jesus would want to dwell upon or think about, but just be aware that that kind of thing is real. Now, I don't know who told you this, could have been a member of the family, but there may be some truth to that. And given the strange circumstances and the dramatic change in personality that you've described in your son, who was not raised this way and who never really was this way until he took up with this woman that he's married to, there may be something really important to take note of there. It may, in fact, be involving in some way the occult. Now, from a distance, there's a few things you could do. Of course, you could pray for your son in a special way. Pray against this if, in fact, it's real. Ask a priest to pray prayers of intervention and deliverance for your son. And be aware that if this kind of thing really is going on, then that's a whole additional problem unto itself. Now, I want to share with you, by way of history, an example of what I'm talking about here. You know, the great Saint Teresa of Avila. Everybody knows her. She was a Carmelite sister in Spain, and I believe she was alive in the 1600s. And there's in her biography, she tells a story about how when she went to spend some time at a different convent in another part of Spain, and she was going to be there for some time, that she, when she was there, she would go to confession to a particular priest who was assigned to that parish, and the convent that she was staying at was either connected to the parish but or very close to it. So anyway, she's going to this priest for confession, and he's a diocesan priest. And he's a bad priest. And she becomes aware of this pretty quickly, partly because of the town's people's gossip and the rumor mill. You know how that can be. And she also can detect in the priest himself certain oddities, some strange behavior on his part. And he kind of becomes a little bit obsessed with St. Teresa of Avila. Nothing happens, but she's aware that there's something wrong. And it turns out that what had happened was that he, as a parish priest, of course, he was supposed to be continent. He was supposed to be celibate. And yet he had a concubine. There was a woman in the village with whom he was carrying on as if she were his wife. Now, what had happened and what came to light, what St. Teresa of Avila describes, is that this woman, his concubine, had indeed exerted a kind of hypnotic spiritual control over this priest, and part of that involved that she had given him an amulet. There was a little occult figurine now on a, you know, some sort of like a maybe a leather string or a chain or something, and she had given it to this priest and told him to wear it around his neck, and he did. You know, he was dumb. He shouldn't have done it, but he did it. And St. Teresa of Avila discerned that this little amulet, this little figurine, this occult symbol was part of this woman's, the concubine. It was part of her occult effort to control him. So she had kind of put a hex on him. She had put a curse on him because she wanted him for her own immoral purposes and as a way to try to keep him, you know, under control, she had him wearing this occult thing. Now, that idol, that little occult figurine, it did play a kind of spiritual role in his subjugation. So, long story short, St. Teresa of Avila talks about this at some length, but long story short, his deliverance from this enslavement to this woman and his deliverance from the enslavement to his own passions was when he finally got free from this woman, was when St. Teresa told him, take that off. Take it off. Because she had gone out into kind of like the woods nearby, not far from, you know, in the outskirts of the town. She was out there to pray, and she was walking and praying. He shows up. And it looks as though, I mean, the way she describes it, it looked as though maybe he was there to try to do something to her. So she has this confrontation with him. She has a showdown with this priest. And it results in her telling him, take that off. And he's willing to do it, and he does it. He takes it off, and he hands it to her. And rather than keep it, she throws it away. She throws it in, there's like a river or a stream that's going by nearby. So she throws it away, and there it is. And there it stayed. And that was the beginning of his freedom from this hex, from this spell, whatever it was that this woman had cast upon him. And indeed, not long after that, St. Teresa of Avila departed from that area, and she went back to her normal, the convent. And by all appearances, it seemed as though the priest finally was able to get out from under that bad situation and make a good confession, get right with God, and get back on the straight and narrow. So I realize that's somewhat of a digression in the story or in my response to your letter, but it's worth knowing about, so that just be aware this kind of thing does happen. It may not be happening here, but it's possible. Okay, so all of this being the case, what can you do? Obviously, pray for your son. Encourage him to do the right thing. If he's not willing to communicate with you anymore, that may be only temporary. And if I were you, I would pray the novena to Our Lady Undoer of Knots. It's a well-known, long-established novena, and it is asking Our Lady's special assistance before God. In other words, you're asking her to pray and petition God for you. And you, of course, are petitioning God yourself directly, but it's always good to have Our Lady on the case as well. And this is a novena for situations where it seems impossible. There seems to be no solution whatsoever. And Our Lady Undoer of Knots has been known constantly over the years to come through in seemingly miraculous ways. That's one suggestion. Another suggestion would be, and these are not mutually exclusive, I would also recommend pray a novena to St. Joseph, because your son is the husband, is the father. St. Joseph, par excellence, husband and father, the foster father of Jesus. And I would pray in a special way, because St. Joseph is known among his other titles as the terror of demons. And sounds like maybe there's some demonic activity nibbling around the edges of this situation. So I would invoke the powerful intercession of St. Joseph so that he will put those demons to flight by interceding before the throne of Almighty God for your son. Now, how that will end up and what steps your son may take, only God knows. But in your capacity as mother, I would encourage you, just continue steadfastly. Keep praying for him. Keep the lines of communication open. Doesn't mean that you have to put up with the nonsense, you know, if that's what's going on from the woman he's married to. Stand your ground. You know, be polite, be gracious, but at the same time, you don't have to be trampled upon. You don't have to allow your boundaries to be crossed unnecessarily. And I would say just maintain that faithful, steadfast hope in the Lord. Keep praying for your son. And, you know, as long as we're at it, you might even invoke the intercession of St. Teresa of Avila, because she has some experience with this kind of thing. And then stand back and wait for some miracles to happen. Might not happen right away. Might not happen for a long time. But I do believe that with your courageous and patient willingness to wait on the Lord in this situation, that something good will happen. And it may involve the restoration of this marriage. It may involve the conversion of this woman. It may involve a renewal of their relationship. It may involve, on the other hand, maybe if it turns out that they're not, in fact, validly married, it may turn out, you know, maybe God, in God's plan, it will end. You don't know. So all of those things come to my mind as I read and reread and thought about and prayed about your letter. And I'm hopeful that this advice and suggestions will be helpful to you. And maybe you can call me back, or call me rather, or write to me down the road if things change. I'd sure appreciate that. Here's an email that comes in from Jennifer. I love answering emails because we can really dig into some of the details that often are not possible when we're taking phone calls one after the other. I can see by the clock I need to take a quick break here. So I mentioned I have an email from Jennifer, and I'll get to that email and many others right after this quick timeout. You're listening to The Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app. Catholic Order. Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com. Sierra Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio Line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
You know, Kelly, people are going bonkers over this Patrick Madrid guy. Have you heard about him? See? They're going bonkers. So, you know, people come up to me and they say, Regis, you know everybody. You know all the movers and shakers. How do I get in touch with this guy? I don't know. Write him a letter. Send him an email. What do I look like, a carrier pigeon?
Wait, oh yes, wait a minute, Mr. Postman.
Patrick Madrid is on Coast to Coast on Relevant Radio.
Okay, we're back to it now. Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. As I mentioned at the beginning of the program this morning, I want to read quite a few emails because I've got a large backlog. So this next one comes from Jennifer. She says, Patrick, I'm a longtime listener here in Los Angeles. I have a question about the Anglican Catholic Church. She said a friend recently discovered an Anglican Catholic Church in SoCal. She gave me the website. She says, even though their name is St. Mary, my understanding is it's not part of the Catholic Church. Am I correct? She said, are there any parts of the Anglican Church that are currently recognized as being in full communion with the Catholic Church? My understanding is several years ago, there were some Episcopal churches in the U.S. that broke away due to disagreements, and some were allowed into communion with Rome. I was hoping, Patrick, that you could provide an explanation of this phenomenon, the Anglican Catholic Church, and also the state of various parts of the Anglican Church in its relationship to the Catholic Church. Thank you, and thanks to all who make the show possible. What a tremendous resource. Jennifer. Well, Jennifer, thank you. Okay, so several little details here. Number one, the Anglican Church, or the Church of England, it comes from the breakaway of King Henry VIII in the 16th century, when he abandoned the Catholic Church in pursuit of a divorce that the Pope would not permit. The Pope would not authorize him to divorce his lawfully wedded wife so that he could take up with another woman. And he was pretty steamed about that. So one thing led to another, and he said, okay, fine, I'll take my marbles and go home, and I'll start my own church. And that's where the Church of England started. It's a national church, and the head of the Church of England is the monarch, whoever is the ruling monarch at that time. So the history is important to keep in mind, because it was King Henry VIII who forced all of the subjects in the realm who were Catholic. Keep in mind that England, the British Isles for the most part, but England certainly, had been Catholic for nearly 1,000 years, maybe even a bit more than 1,000 years, by the time the Church of England came into existence. You know, it's not a real thing. It's legally real, I guess, but it's not a real church. It was just something cobbled out of thin air because King Henry VIII, well, you know the story. So King Henry VIII forced all the subjects of the realm to go into schism and heresy because he wanted a divorce. So from that point forward, the Church of England became inextricably associated with England or Great Britain with regard to its other lands. We would think in terms of the UK today, but this was part of the British Empire, and let's stop and think about what was going on 500 years ago, not to mention in the subsequent centuries. At that time, there was a massive struggle between the two world superpowers in the West, anyway, and that was Spain and England. So England not only was a superpower vying with Spain for riches and exploration and discovery and claiming new lands and all everything that went with that, military superiority, superiority in trade and commerce, etc. But now England had its own church. So part of the polemics that arose almost immediately when King Henry VIII left the Catholic Church were religious polemics that were designed to help galvanize the British public, the people of the empire, to help galvanize their allegiance in favor of the king and in favor of the Church of England and against Spain and the Catholic Church. So it was a handy double-sided stick to beat the church with. That's probably not a great analogy because every stick has two sides, but you get the idea. It was handy to be able to do these psyops against the Spaniards, in part for political and commercial reasons and also for religious reasons. So part of what happened was that the Anglican Church in its polemics, more and more, and this developed over time, but more and more it began to style itself as a kind of via media, which is a Latin phrase that means the middle way. And some of the polemicists began to say, well, the Roman Catholic Church is just a branch, an offshoot of the ancient Catholic Church, of which we are also a branch. So they would say that the Eastern Orthodox was a branch of the Catholic Church, but with their own special version, their own special flavor. The quote-unquote Roman Catholic Church was another branch. The Church of England styled itself as another branch or a via media between the Catholic Church and the Eastern Orthodox churches, which, by the way, had broken off from the Catholic Church. And so this was woven into this narrative that the Church of England was, you know, just another version of the Catholic Church. Now, that's not true. Certainly, historically, it's not true. And if you want a thoroughgoing refutation of that notion, I would just simply take a look at St. John Henry Newman's massive monumental work called An Essay on the Development of Christian Doctrine, which he originally intended to write as a refutation of the Catholic Church. He believed that the Catholic Church was corrupt and was buried under the excrescences of man-made tradition. He was a member of the Church of England. He was a clergyman in the Church of England. And so not only did he want to vindicate the Church of England, he wanted to, as best he could, refute the claims of the Catholic Church. And that's the project he undertook to write about. But it turns out, the more he did his research, the more he could not argue against the fact that the early church, the early church, post-apostolic era, he couldn't avoid the fact that it was Catholic with a capital C. And he had the intellectual honesty to get to the point where he said, I can't argue against this. The evidence is overwhelming. The early church was Catholic. It certainly wasn't Anglican. Certainly wasn't Eastern Orthodox in the sense that we know it today. I mean, although the Eastern Orthodox that we know of today, they were part of the Catholic Church then. But it was a capital C Catholic Church. And so John Henry Newman wound up converting. He left the Church of England. In other words, he left the Anglican Church and he became a Catholic. It caused a huge stir. Now, the reason I'm referencing these things by way of background is because it will help you understand why groups like this claim to be part of the Catholic Church. This is all intended to show you the context so that even today there are, I'm sure, well-meaning, well-intentioned, sincere, God-fearing folk in the Anglican Church who truly believe that they are part of the Catholic Church when they're not. But I don't fault them for their sincerity, but you can be sincere about many things and still be wrong about them. And this is one of those examples. So my guess is, although I'm not familiar with this particular church, my guess is that they're simply, by the virtue of their title, you know, the St. Miscellaneous Anglican Catholic Church, it's their way of expressing that claim that, yeah, we're part of the Catholic Church. We're just not part of the Roman Catholic Church. But they would say, we have the sacraments, and we've got statues of Mary, and we've got, you know, you want some Gregorian chant? We've got some of that too, I would guess. But all of that does not make one Catholic. And in this case, it's an example of the breakaways that took place. And that leads to the second part of your question, which has to do with the, you mentioned several years ago, there were some Episcopal churches in the U.S. that broke away due to disagreements, and some were allowed into communion with Rome. Well, the specific way to explain that would be Pope Benedict XVI. He in a motu proprio, that's a Latin phrase that means by his own volition or under his own will, he established what's known as an ordinariate. An ordinary is the bishop. Typically, it would be the bishop of a diocese. He's the ordinary of the diocese. So an ordinariate, in this case, is an ecclesiastical structure that Pope Benedict XVI erected so that those who were in the Church of England, whether there in England or anywhere else for that matter, or members of one of the affiliated churches, so the Episcopal Church in the United States is the Church of England in the United States, but it has that name, the Episcopal Church, because let's not forget that the American Revolution was founded upon a breakaway from England. And so what we think of today as Episcopal churches in the United States at that time were Church of England churches. And because the United States had successfully rebelled against England, the idea of having the Church of England in, you know, the States did not sound so good. It did not go over so well. So the name was known at that point as the Episcopal Church, but it's an affiliated, or you might say kind of a regional branch, if you want to think of it in those terms, of the Anglican Church. So what Pope Benedict XVI did was he established this legal structure, a juridical person, so to speak, in the form of this ordinariate, which meant that under the authority of the ordinary that he appointed for this in not just in the United States, but elsewhere as well, that those members of the Church of England or the Episcopal Church or other churches that were affiliated with the Church of England, they could come into the Catholic Church, their bishops, I knew at least one of their bishops, he was the Bishop of London. And he actually left the Church of England, and the Church of England Bishop of London, and he became a Catholic, and he was ordained a priest, and he has since died, but he entered into the ordinariate because he wanted to live as a Catholic. And so that's what that is all about. And it's easy to look up if you want to find out more about them. One of the distinctives about the ordinariate is that they have, by permission of the Catholic Church, they have been permitted to keep some of the prayer forms and things that were common to them in the Church of England. So it would be reminiscent to them, and many of the beautiful things of the Church of England liturgically were allowed to remain in the ordinariate. So there you have it. Again, maybe a little bit longer of an answer than you thought I would give you, but sometimes it's good to go a little bit deeper into that. Here's a quick one. This comes from Josefa. She says, "Hello, Patrick. I'd like to get some suggestions on what I can give as a gift to my niece who's 16, but will be having her confirmation, and also for a nephew who is 18. Thank you." Well, I mean, there's so many ways you could go about this. It depends on if they like to read. I mean, I'm always a big proponent of giving people books. As an author myself, I always like it when people buy books. But if you think that they're readers, I would suggest maybe getting both of them a book by Frank Sheed. It's called Theology for Beginners. It's a very helpful book that will give them a look at the underpinnings of why they're Catholic. You know, why do we believe in God at all? And why do we believe in Jesus as the Son of God? Why do we believe in the resurrection? And then kind of building your way up from there. That, I think, would be a very good thing if you're interested in doing that. If they don't have a Bible, I would recommend that you get each one of them a Bible. And the two that I tend to recommend the most would be the Ignatius Bible. It's the Revised Standard Version Catholic Edition. Also, the Augustine Bible, which is in a different translation, but it's also approved by the Catholic Church, and it's also quite good. Those two would be good, and that's the kind of thing that would stay with them through their entire lives. If you're looking for things that will assist them in, you know, family life as they get old enough to start looking at marriage, I like Steve Wood's two books. Again, Steve Wood is the author. The first book is called The ABCs of Finding a Good Wife. That's for the boys. And The ABCs of Finding a Good Husband, that's for the girls. And that's the kind of book that even at their age now, even though they can't necessarily get married now, they'll probably not be too far off from looking at marriage, and this would be a good preparation for them. I hope that's helpful to you, Josefa. I have to take another break, but I'll be back with more of your emails right here on The Patrick Madrid Show.
You know, having that peace, that's going to be absolute confirmation that you have been following God's will, that you understood where God was calling you, you accepted that, you acted on it, and God will give you that peace.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think, you know, we kind of buy into things that we think are going to give us peace or joy or happiness. Paul talks about it in Colossians 2, 6 to 10. He's saying, no, be rooted in love, walk in Him. See to it that no one captivates you with empty philosophy. So we could be what a friend had once called self-propelled Christians. So without God's love, it's almost like we're Fred Flintstone.
I guess it's kind of relaxing to know I'm at the wheel.
Relaxing nothing. It's terrifying.
We're trying to push ourselves. God's like, you're being the protagonist. He says, let me do it. And when we do, you know, that peace is actually going to start to come up within us.
The Inner Life with Josh Raymond.
11 a.m. Central on Relevant Radio.
Today's programming sponsored in part by St. Gregory Recovery Center. More information about their Catholic-centered recovery from substance abuse is available at relevantradio.com/stgregory.
You have one new message.
Hi, Patrick. This is former President Bill Clinton. Look, I just want to tell you, I love your show. I bet you get a lot of emails. You know, come to think of it, if you need a private email server, I know someone that can get you one.
You've got mail.
Oh yes, wait a minute, Mr. Postman. Wait, hey.
Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and relevantradio.com.
We're back. Thank you for listening to the program once again. I sure appreciate it. And if you're tuning in this morning and you're saying, well, where are the phone calls? I've made an executive decision. I think today I just want to stick with emails simply because we have so many of them. And we'll have more when I mention this. If you want to send me an email, just go to relevantradio.com/Patrick. Just beneath where it says The Patrick Madrid Show, you're going to see three blue buttons. One says About. That'll tell you about the show. One says Links. That gives you plenty of links to books and things. And the third one is Contact. And if you click that button, it gives you a place where you can send me an email. And these emails come directly to me. I read all of them. I appreciate all of them. And if you'd like to send me something that I will possibly read on the air, that's the way to do it. This email comes in from Kat. She says, blessings, Patrick. I really enjoyed listening to yesterday's show. The discussions on marriage caught my attention. I've never been married. I would like to be to the right person if it's God's will. But more than anything, I love and trust God, and I want to live according to his will for me. At my age, and she's in her mid-40s, she says, at my age, if I were to marry, it's likely that any gentleman I meet will be divorced, widowed, or the dreaded separated status. I recently found myself explaining to someone I truly care about that separated is not a status and that they were actually still married, regardless if they have been living separately from their spouse for several years. We went back and forth on the topic for a few minutes, and he finally acknowledged that we have a different outlook on marriage. I smiled sadly and said, yes, we do. Since then, I've been reading articles on the topic of annulments in marriage via Catholic Answers in hopes of providing my friend with a better explanation of God's plan in the marriage sacrament without offending or passing judgment. I think this is very painful, confusing, and a complicated topic for many people who don't know or don't understand the sacrament of marriage. But there's always hope and a way forward with Jesus. Thank you for discussing this topic. And she says, regards, Kat. Okay, Kat, thank you. And you know, I can only imagine. I got married when I was 20 years old. And Nancy and I have been married now for just a whisker shy of 41 years. So my whole adult life, I've been married. And I don't know what it's like to go years and years desiring to be married but not finding the right person. And I know that you're in good company because there are many other men and women who are in the same situation you're in. You really desire to be married, but for whatever reason, the right person hasn't come along yet. Looking for the Right One is a song by Art Garfunkel. Breakaway is the album. Came out in, I don't know, 79 maybe, 1979. It's a very poignant song. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but if you look up that album, Breakaway, and there's a song by that same title on the album. There's a very poignant song called Looking for the Right One. And if you get a chance, you know, pop onto Apple Music or Spotify or wherever you get your music and maybe listen to it. Because when I first read your email, I thought about that song and the cross that many people just like you are carrying because you haven't found the right one yet. So let's get to the specific issue here. You're absolutely right. And the gentleman that you're talking to is deluding himself. I mean, presuming he's Catholic. He's deluding himself if he thinks that by checking the separated box that somehow makes him eligible for romance. It doesn't. And a quick tutorial, not for your sake, because you already know this, but maybe you could share it with him, is that the church presumes as its default position that, you know, if you see people getting married, the presumption is that it's a valid marriage until and unless it can be demonstrated as invalid. So the church takes the sacrament of holy matrimony very seriously. And as I mentioned a moment ago, the vow includes till death do us part, meaning that when the couple exchanges the marriage contract and they give their public consent to each other, and in the case of two baptized Catholics, they enter into the sacrament of holy matrimony, the church recognizes that as a durable bond that is unbreakable until one or the other parties dies. So the till death do us part, the till death do us part kicks in there. So that's why if the man, whoever he is, separated from his wife, they're not divorced, even the divorce itself certainly would not qualify him for romance, because the church says, well, you may be divorced civilly, but if you have a valid marriage, and the presumption is that you do until it can be proven otherwise, then you're still married. Even if you have a piece of paper that civilly says you're divorced, in the eyes of God and the church, your marriage, if it is valid, remains. So you're not free to go out and start dating. You're not free, certainly not free to do anything more than that. You're not free to become physically intimate with anybody because you're still married. And I don't think that needs to be explained. I mean, it's once you see that that's the church's presumption, it really doesn't require much by way of explanation. But it doesn't sound like he got that memo. So my advice would be, if you want to share with him something that will be authoritative, and, you know, I don't think it will necessarily convince him right away, but it's certainly going to give him no wiggle room, and that would be have him read a book called Annulments in the Catholic Church, Straight Answers to Tough Questions. It's a book written by a canon lawyer. His name is Ed Peters. And this book lays it all out. It's in a question and answer format, but this particular issue is one example of that, where he explains it. And he gives a lot of the building blocks so that this gentleman can understand what marriage really is, and how, if he's on, you know, the whatever.com dating website, the fact that he's checked the box that says separated, it doesn't mean anything. He might as well have checked the box married, in which case he shouldn't be on the dating website in any case. But the fact is, you're right about that. Now, maybe if indeed there are grounds for an annulment, and only the church can make that determination, but maybe if you get him a copy of this book, or suggest that he get it, I don't think you should be the one paying for it, but let him read this book, Annulments in the Catholic Church, Straight Answers to Tough Questions. The maybe here is that maybe he will say, you know what, maybe I don't have a valid marriage, and I'm willing to undergo the church's process of determining whether or not that was in fact a valid marriage. And who knows, maybe it wasn't a valid marriage. Now, he can't act upon that assumption until and unless the church grants that decree. But in the meantime, it would give him some food for thought. And if he's motivated to make that determination, it could wind up that he would say a year from now, 6 months from now, what have you, he may say, well, the church looked into it, I didn't have a valid marriage, I am free to be on the dating.com website, you know. But then again, he may find out that the church says, nope, you have a valid marriage, in which case you need to get off that website. I would do it anyway, and reconcile with your wife if it's at all possible. So those are some thoughts on that topic. And I want to assure you of my prayers, Kat, that as you're looking for the right one, that the right one will come along. This is a very common and sad situation for many people. I've even thought, I mean, I don't have the wherewithal to do this, but I've even thought about, you know, maybe setting up an introduction service for people that I know personally, young men and young women, not all of whom are necessarily that young, but they're in the same situation where they're looking for a spouse and they're just not finding them. I don't think that's in the cards for me. Maybe somebody listening right now will pick up that baton and run with it. But I know there are some very good Catholic dating websites out there, and that's another avenue. Now, one thing, too, I'll mention, only because I've got to take a break here in just a minute, but here's another thing to think about. Nancy and I were very good friends with a couple who went to our parish, and they're a little bit younger than us, but they had a bunch of kids, too. And he contracted brain cancer, and he died after a few years of suffering. And he left his wife a widow, and his children, some of them were grown up, some of them were still small, some of them were still in the house. And his wife, who at the time I think was in her, I don't know, she was probably in her mid-40s, after a few years, she was ready to start looking again. And she registered on one of these Catholic dating websites. And she actually got to the point where she was going to cancel her subscription because she didn't think it was working. And at the last moment, it seems, she was messaged, this guy messaged her And not only, here's the happy ending, not only did were they right for each other, they wound up getting married, very happy family. But here's the kicker, and this is what I wanted to share with you, Kat. This man, who also at that time was in his mid to late 40s, he had never been married. He was a good, devout Catholic guy who, like you, was looking for a wife. In your case, you're looking for a husband. He was looking for a wife, looking for a wife, never quite found the right one. But he was a faithful Catholic, church-going Catholic. He was not out playing the field or anything like that, but he just hadn't found the right one. So it was on this Catholic dating website that they finally made the connection. One thing leads to another. They begin dating because they're both free to date. They fall in love, they get married. And they've been married now for several years and going strong and very happy. So I reference that story only because I know it personally, but also to give you a little bit of hope that it's not inevitable that a man that you might meet would be divorced or a widow, a widower. There are some guys out there who are perfectly fine in every respect. I kind of wondered, how come this guy never got married before? He's such a great guy. Well, because in God's providence, he hadn't met the woman that God intended for him. But he did, and now they're married. So another reason for hope. Well, we're going to leave it at that for this hour. I'll be back with hour three in just a few minutes. Please stay right where you are. I've got plenty more ahead. And we'll get to all of that on the other side of this quick timeout. You're listening to The Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.